listener. Here we go.
Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon to everybody. This is the Ron Brooks Show. And today we have a special guest. I'm really excited about having a philosopher Greg Salamieri here with us. We're going to talk about primarily about self-interest, but we'll probably go in a bunch of different directions. But before we do that, I should have asked you to prepare something. But Greg, could you just basically introduce yourself? I mean, just tell people, you know, what you've done, where you come from, and what you're doing right now.
All right. I'm a philosopher. I teach at a class or two a semester at Rutgers University. I'm a fellow with the Ansem Foundation, and I also do some work for the Ayn Rand Institute. Those two are a bit intertwined. Right now I'm doing the Atlas Project, which is a Tuesday night every week broadcast where we discuss Atlas Shrugged chapter by chapter. We're just getting up to part 3, chapter 7. As for what I've done, I'm one of the co-secretaries, I guess, of the Ayn Rand Society, which is a group of professional philosophers interested in Rand's work. I guess of the things I've done in the past, the one I'm proudest of and that's most relevant is a companion to Ayn Rand, which is part of the Blackwell Companions to Philosophy series. And it's, I think, the only really reference-style work on Ayn Rand's thought, and it covers her philosophy as well as her literature or her views on contemporary political events of her time, and I think is a real step forward in scholarship of her. So the book's pretty expensive. You can get it semi-affordably on Kindle, and if, you know, it should be in every library. So if it's not in yours, go, you know, complain at them and request it until it gets there. I think those are the main highlights.
Well, somebody mentioned, just because it's on the video, that you're an avid musician, because they can see the drums, the guitar, the equipment behind you.
Yeah, I'm mostly a guitar player and some other instruments. Drums are a recent kind of experiment. They're mostly here so other people can come and play with me, but I've been trying my hand at them.
Greg does a great Bob Dylan, so... But yeah, I highly recommend the book. It's worth the money, particularly on the Kindle, because the Kindle is more reasonable. I can't remember what I think I saw it last at $30 or $40 on the Kindle.
Yeah, somewhere in the $30 range.
Yeah, in the $30 range. $30, it's definitely should be a buy. You should have it. I have my entire Objectivist library on my iPad, so I can access it anytime I want, and the companion's on there. And you guys should definitely get it. Great. So let's jump in and we've talked a little bit about the fact I've done a debate now on selfishness, and I did this discussion with Sargon of Akkad on self-interest. But I think this is an experience objectivists have generally of trying to get through to people, trying to explain self-interest to people out there in the world, and trying to articulate what it is, and to try to get them away from the package deal that most people hold self-interest as right now. So I'm wondering, just broadly, what are your thoughts on the whole issue? What are techniques that you find are more useful in breaking through to people? And what do you think the barriers are, the cognitive barriers are, for people to actually integrate this, actually at least see a glimmer of what we're trying to explain to them?
I think there are a few things. I mean, one is that talking about self-interest, and especially about selfishness, is radical. And I think we have to own that and understand why Rand is using the language of selfishness, which is confrontational kind of language, why the concept of self, and, you know, we should sometimes use that language, not in every single conversation necessarily, and understand why she's feels the need to do that. And I think she's right to feel the need to do it often. We could talk a bit about that. And understand in what ways this is a real departure from ordinary moral thinking and in what ways there's some continuity. We're not saying everything everybody thought is wrong. So the understanding how objectivism relates to common sense, in what ways it's radical and in what ways it's preserving features that people already think, is something we have to think about. A second is that the prevalence of altruism in common sense moral thinking really poses a barrier to people thinking about what their self-interest is. And I think we see that a lot in the kind of responses we get. So there's a kind of deficit people have in even thinking about what it would be to live for themselves, what it would be to serve their self-interest, what's good for them. And I think we both have to point that fact out and think about ways to combat it. And then a third thing is, I don't think it's enough to preach selfishness. I think one always has to do it in a context that gives some more positive content to the view of self-interest. So we have to talk about the specific virtues in a way that gives enough content to indicate how honesty, integrity, productiveness, rationality are parts of self-interest. And I don't think just rationality, although that's the central one, is enough because it's so abstract. Mm-hmm. And people will think of rationality in connection with self-interest in the way economists do, of scheming to get the things we all automatically want in a clever way. So one has to think about some of the other virtues and how they tie in. And those, I would think, are the ingredients to discussing this well. But I don't have a magic formula that always works well in conversations. Yeah. I seem to make headway with my students.
We'd be winning if you did. So we are winning. Let's not be too pessimistic here. We are winning one mind at a time. Let's start with the first one you mentioned. How would you describe the way in which these ideas are indeed radical?
Well, I think the way to think about it is, Galt talks about in Atlas Shrugged about naming the way that people are living in those moments when they are living, naming what people live by. And that's how one of the people he recruits to his cause describes what he did. He just named what I'd always lived by. Mm-hmm. And it's not true that everybody always lives by what Galt preaches, what Ayn Rand recommends, but it is what people live by to the extent that they're really living, to the extent that they're good, to the extent that they're accomplishing something in life, and to the extent that they have real values, things that they care about and love, and that their life's about those things. So I think in that sense, it's appealing to content that people already have, that people already know is good, that people already, excuse me, can evaluate positively, and that the world has been there's always been some of that in how people lived, otherwise people wouldn't have survived. And then there's more and more of it, at least in certain segments of the world. If you go on a century scale, modern America is a fantastic place to live. There are lots of people pursuing their values. There's Silicon Valley and the whole Silicon Valley mindset. There's more and more people feeling empowered and thinking that they should be. So in that sense, there's something in all human beings, and especially in modern American and more broadly Western culture, that we are picking up on, or Ayn Rand is picking up on. And I think we have to acknowledge that and own that and direct people towards that. On the other hand, those things have not been, and have certainly not been consistently identified as what's morally good. And insofar as there have been explicit codes of what's morally good, they've had little bits of that positive content in them, but the integrating principle for them has always been something that's antithetical to to life on earth, and antithetical to an individual's life on earth and happiness. So whether it's God, some magic person who's supposed to tell you what to do and who to sacrifice to, or whether it's the society, or whether it's in the more technical realms, Kantian ethics or environmental ethics, it's always about sacrificing yourself to some set of duties of one sort or another. And we're very radical in rejecting that, or Rand was, and I am, and you. And in seeing how deeply that mindset has infected moral thinking, even in cases where it's not obviously about that, and how deeply it's infected the way that people talk about and think about both what's good and what's good for them.
All right. So, you know, the comments online always distract me.
Let me take a look. I can only see the Facebook.
No, that's right. Fine. That's fine. Actually, there are no comments on Facebook. Everybody is silent and they concentrate. Oh,
someone said they love us on
you.
Facebook.
Yes, no, I don't count those as comments. The hellos well, and the loves don't count. Nobody's actually commenting. I think it's your gravitas is here. Everybody's worried about saying anything, so that's good. We've got an expert in the house. They comment on everything I say.
I'm sure they'll get going. If we weren't anything political, people will yell at us.
Yeah, I'm sure. There's a comment here on – I mean, this is kind of – I get this all the time, right? There's a comment here on YouTube that says, look, capitalism is 100% justified itself on practical grounds. It works. So why do we need an ethical case? Why worry, right? And I wrote in response, practical for what?
That was my first thought too.
Yes. Because practical for what? What is – so you're saying to create wealth. Well, is wealth a good thing or a bad thing? By what standard? Wealth for whom? What about the people who don't create wealth? Should we care about them? Should they have a higher priority than those who do create the wealth? And you could go on and on and on. All of those questions are questions of is poverty bad? So you say because all other options lead to poverty. Is poverty bad? Christianity doesn't think so, right? The meek shall inherit the earth. Mother Teresa didn't think poverty was bad. She just prevented people from dying, but worked hard to keep them poor. So all of those are moral questions. You cannot escape morality when you're talking about practical issues that deal with human beings.
Yeah, and if you think something's, I mean, even the practical case for capitalism, right, requires integrating a lot of knowledge over time. And if you think that it's depraved, you're going to always be looking for ways in which it doesn't work. The definitions of it are going to be shifting in your head. And it's not the case that everybody who's looked into or purported to look into the practical case for it thinks that the practical case is persuasive. It's the people who have looked into it and have moral views that value prosperity, that value individual achievement, that value upward mobility of an individual in the society, people whose views of what's good or different don't, in fact, see it as practical.
Yeah.
And it's not obvious. I mean, in a way, it is obvious, but it's not self-evident and it's not uncontroversial. The moral views that you're assuming in viewing it as practical are right. And that's why it's not persuasive to show that it's practical to you.
Yes, I mean, a lot of very smart people who claim to advocate for a reason and for a lot of good things are anti-capitalist exactly for these reasons. Sam Harris, Pinker, a lot of these guys are very smart. They're very knowledgeable. They know history. And yet their interpretation of history is skewed because of their moral views. And their interpretation of capitalism is as a consequence.
And if they say, therefore, capitalism, therefore, you know, a modern regulated capitalism where nobody can get too rich and there's a social safety net and this and then that and then the other thing. And it requires moral premises to answer the question of which thing is capitalism. Is capitalism laissez-faire or is capitalism something else? What is it that's causing the prosperity? Because all of these countries that got richer, right, none of them had what we think is capitalism perfectly, nor have they had perfectly the system that anybody else advocates. So you have to tease out from the history of what worked and what didn't, which are the elements that were doing the work to make it work.
Yeah.
And your views about what's causally significant there are deeply connected to your views about what's right and wrong about it.
Absolutely.
And if you have very different views, you'll have very different views of what working is and why the things that worked have worked.
So let's go back to this issue of self-interest. And so you said something. You said that to the extent that people are successful in life, Silicon Valley, or just people who are productive and successful in living, are in some ways being self-interested morally. So tell us more about that, and in what way, since they don't hold the morality, they don't hold it as a moral code, how is it driving them to behave in these things? What is it that's driving to behave these things, particularly given that what they hold as a moral code would drive them away from this kind of behavior?
Yeah, I think the way to think about it is, what do these people value? What are their lives about to them? And then thinking about how valuing itself is selfish. So if you think of someone like a Steve Jobs or a Bill Gates or someone who's been successful in any industry or just anyone who's happy, right? There are things that are important to them, their career, their family, their kids, their hobbies. But especially, I think, for somebody who's really happy, their career, including parenting as a kind of quasi or semi-career, offshoot career. And they have a particular view about what that thing is and what its place in their life is. And they're thinking about how the rest of their life relates to that. And that has a kind of priority for them. Also, you know, other projects or causes they might be involved in, some of them might have this role, not all of them usually. But there's some kind of center to their life that their life's about. And they think about that in connection to all the other things they do. They experience love for it. They work for it. They evaluate other things in connection to it, and they shape their life around it. So their life has some direction. They have some sense of meaning or what their life's about that comes from the core values they have, the core commitments they have. And I mean here concrete, not things like justice, unless your career is being a cop or something that's actually concretely promoting justice, but some thing that you do in the world, that you're trying to achieve something by doing it. And you're trying to build a life around that. So you want it to be remunerative so that you can live by doing it. And it's not just a hobby, right? You see the kind of, there was an Onion article I really like that came out a few years ago saying, you know, find something you passionately love and then do it on nights and weekends for the rest of your life, right? And the joke was, of course, you shouldn't do that. If you can, you should find a way to make a career out of that. Make that what you do. And then you could have, you know, a drum kit and do music on the weekend. But I think a lot of people and the best people, particularly when they're young and when they're older, if they've been really successful, have that as an important part of their thinking about life and about what they want to raise their kids to do and the kind of advice they give to people. And that is, call it before we call it selfishness, let's call it the morality of life.
Yeah.
That is the code or way of living by which human beings sustain themselves. And then in what sense is it selfish? Well, it's something you can only do for yourself. Nobody else can pick something and make it of tremendous value to you and make it give your life meaning and infuse you with joy and make you motivated towards it. And you can't do it for anybody else. And if you're going to have that kind of value at all, you can only have it for yourself. Values aren't just out there in the world to be achieved. Things just don't have some glow to them that calls to people or calls to everybody. If they call out to you or are attractive to you, it's because of something you're doing. You've made them important to you. You've invested them with that value and meaning and significance, and you've invested them with that for you. And if you don't do it, the world will be a bleak and boring and empty, depressing place for you. And again, you can't do it for other people except by inspiring them in ways. But you can only do that by first having values and achieving them and going after them and being a happy, energetic, productive, creative person. And again, that's something you can only do for yourself. So the whole process of living, of coming up with values, of achieving them, of figuring out what things are really valuable, is something that one does as an individual. We don't do it as collectives. And we can't do it for one another. And in that sense, to value, to really live, is to be selfish. And the alternative is a kind of gray indifference or resentment or boredom.
or hatred, or kind of the nihilism that is common today. I think all the results of the lack of that. So
yeah, I think.
Yes. So would you say that people hold, in a sense, an implicit selfish moral code in spite of kind of the explicit moral code that they claim to hold? Or would you say it's not even morality because it's not at that level?
I think it depends on the person. So the people of someone like Steve Jobs, I would say he definitely held an implicit moral code. Someone who's a real, hero, despite some, uglier episodes in his life, where I don't think he was being selfish. But of someone like that, of someone like Hank Reardon in Atlas Shrugged, before he learns the full philosophy, I would say he definitely had an implicit code. His life had a direction. It was focused. I think for most people, it doesn't rise to that level of a consistent code directing their life. But there are elements of it in them. And those elements of it in them are what give them genuine self-esteem, genuine joy, genuine enthusiasm. It's what enables them to actually experience love for other people and also for other things. And it's reinforced by whatever actions they take in pursuit of those loves.
So what would you say to people? Sargon said this, but I get this a lot, particularly from libertarians. Well, we're all self-interested all the time. I mean, it's coded in our genes. Everybody wants to have a better life. Everybody is pursuing life in one way or another. Selfishness is just how we are. Little babies are selfish. And then, in a sense, to the extent that they get to this point, they would say, well, you need morality to kind of tone that down a little bit and control it a little bit, because selfishness is just the way we are.
Well, let's think of it first about self-interest. And then come to selfishness later, because selfishness has this extra connotation of being a derogatory term. And there are some questions about what exactly it means. But let's start with the idea of self-interest. And what do we need this word self-interest for if everything anybody ever does is self-interest? It's like saying, every color is pink. And if someone shows you something that's not pink, doesn't appear to be pink, looks very different from pink, they tell you, well, but it's really pink deep down or something. If you understand true pinkness, everything is pink. If everything turns out to be X, it's dubious why we need this word X. Now, there are a few words, existence or something, that are meant to assume everything. But we have a whole lot of words to do with our motivational sets, right? What motivates us? Desire, motive, incentive, want, self-interest is a fairly complicated term. First of all, it's two words bunched together. What is meant by it? Why do we need such a term? And I take it that you need such a term to think about there are different people's interests. They can possibly conflict. There are different motives that people can have. And you want to know when people are acting on the motive of their own interest as opposed to somebody else's interest, or as opposed to acting in some way at random or without any thought to anyone's interest. If you didn't have that context of a contrast, you want to say, here's when we're acting self-interested versus here's when we're not, there'd be no context and no need for this term. So if even when you're giving up everything you love because of some feeling of guilt and some, need to sacrifice, and if even Mother Teresa is acting on her self-interest, then there's no use for a word like that. It includes everything and doesn't mean much. But even apart from that, I think the concept of self-interest, even if we put aside clear cases of intentional sacrifices that are viewed as I'm giving up my self-interest, if you think about the role of a concept of interest in reasoning, right, the concept of anyone's interest, as opposed to just saying desire or what you want, it's the concept that does the work of summing up over time and over areas of your life to give you a view of what's on the whole good for you. So if you just have the idea of my desires, then you don't yet have the idea of self-interest. To have the idea of what promotes my self-interest rather than what feeds my hunger or quenches my thirst or satisfies whatever other desire I might have now. You have to have the idea that you've got a lot of desires. You'll have different ones over time. Some of them might pull you in opposite directions. And you're thinking about sort of what is in general good for me, as opposed to these many desires, which might be in conflict with one another. And then there are different theories. Maybe your self-interest is what fulfills as many of your desires as possible, or the strongest ones, or maybe it's not really about desire. But there's some, you don't have the idea of someone's interest or your own self-interest until you have the idea of something other than the many discrete desires. And then you think about what is this thing that is good for you as a whole or in general, rather than just in this moment versus that moment, or what you want in this moment versus that moment.
Yeah. It's interesting how you approach it. I mean, you approach it, very epistemologically from looking, okay, why do we need this concept? What does this concept denote as compared to other concepts that denote something that seems similar? What cognitively is being activated by using self-interest? And that's great.
I should say that idea of self-interest is something over and above, the desires of a given moment.
Yeah.
Or any one subset of your desires isn't something that's distinctive to me or distinctive to objectivism. I mean, philosophers who have thought about a person's interests, including some who are not egoists, some who are utilitarians and so forth, have often thought about this. Because, if you're going to try to achieve, say, the greatest happiness for the greatest number, and you're going to be serious about it, you want to try to think about, well, what is that? Giving everybody what they want when they want it? Or how do we tell what's good for people long term? So other philosophers have thought about this. Even Kant thinks about this, right? He thinks that there's a kind of practical reasoning, which is what he calls prudential reasoning. And he separates it off from moral reasoning. And that's his big innovation for the bad, to separate this off from moral reasoning. But it's about figuring out what's good for you might be different from what he calls an immediate inclination, what you want right now. And that's a different thing. And then yet in his view, not in mine, yet a third thing is thinking morally, which doesn't have to do with religion.
So let's talk a little bit. An aspect of this is this idea that, again, comes up in whenever we debate these kind of issues, is the long term versus short term, right? The idea that, okay, what we mean as objectivists is long term rational self-interest. And that's two things, right? Versus short-term or irrational self-interest, both of which. So talk a little bit about the short-term, long-term, and we can also talk about the rational, irrational.
Yeah, I don't think the idea of short-term self-interest makes sense. And I don't think the things that are offered as examples of it are really coherent. I mean, so when you were talking to Sargon, I forget if you or he brought this up, but I think you brought it up as a kind of ridiculous, counterexample, and he started embracing it, of, snorting a line of cocaine, as though that's obviously
because I always use that as an example.
Yeah. As though that's obviously in your immediate or short-term self-interest.
Yeah.
But it's not. I mean, it's not like there's something, at least I got to snort a line of cocaine, something good. I have no desire to snort a line of cocaine. My wife had a medical procedure recently, a minor one, no problem, but she had some pain and she had to be on opiates for a day or two about it. She couldn't wait to get off the thing.
Yep.
It was not pleasant. It's not like the things that people think of as in their automatic short-term self, in their short-term self-interest, are automatically good for them or even automatically desired by everyone. Right. So it's
but
not
they could
like
be pleasurable. Right. So we need to separate those two out as well.
Although even there, I mean, pleasure is a kind of, as a physiological sensation, it's there.
Yeah.
But a lot of pleasures aren't enjoyable. And that is, you don't like having them. Like you feel numb or something, and it's not pleasant in the moment to you. You don't enjoy it, even though the physical sensation is maybe the same one that other people find pleasant or you would find pleasant in a different context. So it's not the case that I'm not doing some cocaine now is a drag, but better for me long range. I had to be on this show this afternoon, and I could have taken some cocaine, but oh no, I better hold off till later or maybe never take it. But damn it, if only I could have cocaine and do the other stuff too. It's not something I want. And it's not something most people want. The same thing with, you know, sleeping with a bunch of sluts or whatever. These aren't, I wish I could do this. I wish I could always be in orgies. And, you know, damn it, I have to give it up. There are occasions where there are pulls in two directions. But when you say, you know, like Ben Shapiro does, you know, staying with your wife and kid is a sacrifice. I mean, what kind of disgusting, creepy view makes you think short term it would be in my self-interest to, you know, sell my kid for money to buy crack? That's a decent person doesn't have that thought. And either someone who says that, like Ben Shapiro, doesn't love his family and doesn't know what love is, or he does, but he's made to suppress that knowledge by this disgusting sewer that he calls a moral code.
Yeah, and partially it's to color the other side, right? It's to create a straw man because he needs that straw man in order to attack. So but it is reflective of himself, right? When he says, "I could have gone with the slut at the bar," he's saying something about himself. He's saying something about the fact that that is, even in his imagination, desirable. That he could imagine a situation where that's desirable, where somebody who is egoistic, who cares about himself in any sense, that is never tempted by that. It's never, ever a desirable thing.
And what it really says to me is that he's, because I don't think he really would be tempted by those things.
I don't think so.
Is that he's thought so little about what he wants out of life.
Yep.
And that is sad, especially for someone who, I mean, I think you have a little more regard for him as a political commentator than I do, but he's someone who's got some integrity, who's productive, who's, you know, whatever we think of the content of his work, has built up an audience in ways that are really impressive, and who's shown some real integrity, breaking with Breitbart at certain times. So he's not someone who's just going by the whims of the moment. And I think he really cares about his career, and I imagine he cares about his family. But all of that he chalks off to something he does because he's got to, right? Because God tells him to.
Yeah, I think that's – I wonder how he chalks it up in his own mind. It would be interesting to talk to him. But I also think that partially people like Ben who are smart and present themselves as intellectuals, they're struggling to come – they're coming up with counter-arguments that they, in a sense, don't really believe in, right? So, you know, as you said, I don't think he's attracted to the slut. I don't think he really thinks anybody or – anybody good would be attracted to the slut. But he can't square that with his understanding of morality and his understanding of an objectivism to the extent he's tried to understand it. So he projects that onto objectivism in a sense, intellectual laziness and a way to get a one-up on the other guy rather than think about it. What I think he's not doing is thinking.
Yeah, I don't mean to say there are no cases of real temptation if you're an egoist or you're an objectivist. There are lots of cases where there's something you know you should do, you have reason to do it, and in the moment it doesn't feel motivating to you. There are cases where you might, you know, not be tempted to go and sell your baby to buy money for crack, but not to do the, maybe you become addicted to crack and maybe that would happen, but not to do the kinds of things that you need to do to sustain your life. There's hard things that are difficult. You discussed an example the other day, I think somewhere, where maybe you have become addicted to opiates through just you were prescribed them, but you find it really hard to get off of them now. And in that kind of a situation, it would be hard to take some willpower or take some work. It would take some real effort to do the thing that you know to be right. But it's the thing that's good for you. And this is true we have to talk about how you know that what's right and what's good for you are the same. But in the case of breaking an opioid addiction, I think it's pretty clear how it's better for you to be off of the drug than on it.
Yep.
Right. And though that's hard, what you can do to bring yourself forward, and likewise for any goal you have, ambitious goal you have, is not imagine some, you know, external God or something chastising you or wanting to punish you for not doing it or some society, but recognize that all the things that you want and value out of life are being compromised or destroyed by this addiction. Or on the other hand, we're talking about achieving something positive, depend on or would be enhanced by getting to this next level in your career, that the various things that frighten you are more frightening if you don't look at them and address them. And it's, you want to connect them to your actual values. And all of the virtues of Rand's morality are virtues that are about doing that, are about recognizing values and learning how to connect things to them, mm-hmm. and to see how certain actions are required by them. And that's how you motivate yourself to do what's hard, not by, you know, scoffing at yourself.
Not by
imagining God doing it.
Yeah, fearing God is going to come down and strike you with a bolt of lightning. It's interesting because on the some of these concretes, it's relatively easy, and this relates to the point you made at the beginning, it's relatively easy to convince people that it's in your self-interest. So, as you said, very few people are tempted by cocaine. Very few people are going to – almost nobody's going to leave their baby or sell their baby, God forbid, to you know, to something. You know, and when you're discussing with people, yeah, this is self-interested, this is self-interested, this is – but they refuse to integrate. So they refuse to, in a sense, integrate those into, yes, I should pursue my self-interest. I see all the values that I have in life were because I pursued my self-interest or pursued interests that were that were motivating to me. But they refuse to kind of integrate that into a principle or into a code of values. What do you think is the barrier? What is really holding them back?
Well, I think there are a couple of things. I mean, one is as soon as other people become involved, there's a real question as to thinking about what is it for other people to be part of or to contribute to your self-interest, especially in a world where the predominant moral views pit other people against the self and then treat anything you do for them as a sacrifice of your interest. So there's just a kind of confusion there. There's also the fact that a lot of people, I mean, people, it's not that people have a worked out coherent notion of their self-interest most of the time in their lives and only fail to have it when they're doing moral philosophy or arguing with moral philosophy. Most people have a fairly disordered set of values and they don't think much about how they go together, and they spend most of their life acting on some type of inertia or others. So if you think about, I mean, most of the actions we do in a most think of the act, the desire someone has in a moment, right? They're not automatically aimed at anything. So, you know, you desire to hold the door open for somebody, you desire to eat a certain thing, you desire to go a certain place, you desire to say a certain thing, it occurs to you to say a certain joke, and you then decide whether to say it or not. It occurs to you the joke might offend somebody, but it might please someone else. And all these different things occur to you. They don't come marked as for me or not for me. They just occur to you as things to do with some motivation to do it. And to think of which of them are in my self-interest is a real project of integrating them. And it's one that each person has to do for themselves, because your interests and mine aren't going to be identical. And any kind of project like that is work. And what people do instead is they don't do any kind of integration. And they take over stale integrations that are already made for them. So they end up with just a heap of desires pulling them in contrary direction. And then they categorize some of them in like what my preacher would have wanted, or what my Sunday school teacher would have said, or what my mother would approve of. And so they have, you know, voices like this, and then what is fun but goes against that. And then lots of things that feel, they don't even bother to think about where they come from, but they're just habits or what everybody does. And the default is not to integrate those things. Integrating those things is an achievement.
Yeah.
And, you know, achievements have to be achieved. And we're not taught to do it, right? We're not taught to think about what we want out of life.
Yes, no, absolutely. And so let's talk a little bit about altruism and kind of how it cripples that ability, because we hold that as a standard and it kind of you know, I think psychologically makes it very difficult to people to acknowledge their self-interest and therefore acknowledge that they should be integrating it or would integrate it. How do you think people hold altruism? Because they're not acting altruistically, not consistently in any kind of way. It more to me seems like for most people, it's more something that prevents them from being self-interested than something that actually makes them, at least in any kind of consistent way, be altruistic.
Yeah, altruism, I mean, there are at least two senses of that word. Even taking it as a moral philosophy rather than just a tendency people have or a type of motive, and there are more meanings when you take it that way. But taking it as a principle, like here's what the principle of altruism says to do. One view is that you should live for other people. And that's what Auguste Comte, who coined the term, said, right? Live for others was his meaning of it. And the other is just, and this is what Rand thinks is the essence of it, really, sacrifice yourself. And those two go together because in the live for others context, the premise is that there's a conflict between what's good for you and what's good for others. And you want to sacrifice or beat down the good for you element, only gratify it or satisfy it insofar as doing so is also good for others. But the way I think people hold it, not the way they hold the word altruism, but the way this affects and impacts them, is the way that Galt says in his speech, which is by taking the self as the standard of evil. So I don't think they have a very clear, there's not a general agreement in our society over what the good is. What there is general agreement about is that whatever it is, it's something that you're compelled to sacrifice yourself to at least some of the time. And if you look at moral philosophy, the way it's worked since Kant, like technical, what people write in journals, that's what the common core is. That's what's coming out of Kant. And that's in some of the more insightful books of people who are trying to do this, you see them noticing that that's what they're doing. It's morality is what it is that I'm obligated to sacrifice to. And so it starts by this idea of the standard of self as evil. And again, people wouldn't put it that way, but you see it in the kinds of things they reach for when they're looking for non-controversial moral statements, mm-hmm. like serve something above yourself, the kind of things that come out in campaigns, or service is the rent we pay, or one conviction should bind us, that the measure of a person's character is how much he's willing to give of himself. Right? All of this, something higher, something other than itself, something which is always left kind of vague. And then people reach for different things to put in it, and what they reach for to put in it depends a little bit on, you know, what particular background they have, but whether it's the nation or whether it's the disadvantaged or underprivileged or whether it's other people or whether it's glorifying God, insofar as someone thinks all of these things or most of them count as noble or could count as noble, it's because they think, well, they're all something that's not me that I could sacrifice what's good for me too. And I think that's how people hold it. And then you can see that at work in the people who are thinking, take the things that are clearly good for them, like their personal relationships with people they love, and wanting to ennoble them by treating the things they do for them as though they were sacrificing, exporting them from their self-interest, which is what you get in the kind of position we were talking about earlier.
Yeah, and it affects everything that they do because they need to hold it in their mind. To hold it in their mind as virtuous, they have to hold it in their mind as sacrificial.
Yeah, and that I think is the really killer premise to someone thinking. So instead, if you have a kind of motley collection of drives is too strong, too psychological, a motley collection of motives, things that seem appealing to you in different moments, right? You can't act on all of them all the time. You have to make choices. And what people think of is something external to them that has to tell them which of their desires they're allowed to act on, rather than building something from themselves that, and based on their own understanding of their nature and of where these desires come from and of what it would take to fulfill them, building something in themselves that integrates the best of these desires, elevates some of them as best because they're the most valuable to you, and then lets you achieve those that are achievable or those that you choose to achieve in a context, in a causal context where you're noticing that all of these have effects, that all of these have causes you have to enact to get to them. You kind of therefore out of that, instead of having many discrete desires, have a vision of some whole thing that you're acting towards. And then you use that to guide you towards something rather than away from various desires that you have to be guided away from because God or the Pope or society or Krugman or someone thinks they're bad.
All right, we're going to take a quick commercial break. I keep forgetting to do these. My sister will be mad at me. And then we'll be right back to talk more.
The Ayn Rand Archives has more than 1,500 photographs of Ayn Rand, her life, and her work. Become an ARI monthly sustainer today, and you are eligible to receive the Ayn Rand photo series every month. These high-quality reproductions, each with historical anecdotes provided by the Archives, will be shipped to you in a protective sleeve and are suitable for framing or for collecting in a photo album. Becoming an ARI monthly sustainer is the most convenient way to contribute. Your automated monthly gift of just $25, that's less than $1 per day, helps to sustain our vital programs and qualifies you to receive the Ayn Rand photo series. When your first monthly contribution is made, you'll receive the first set of two photos. Then for as long as you contribute at least $25 a month, you'll receive an additional set of two photos each month. For residents outside of the United States, a monthly donation of $50 is required to receive the photo series. Signing up is quick and easy. Just go to aynrand.org/donate and look for the link at the bottom of the page to become an ARI sustainer.
All right, we are back with philosopher Greg Solomieri. We're talking about self-interest. And one more thing I wanted to, before we move on, I want to talk about with regard to altruism. And the way people use the term sacrifice. And the reason this keeps coming back is, I mean, it's obvious because people use it in all kinds of mixed ways. But I've noticed Jordan Peterson is promoting the confusion about the term by using sacrifice to denote any delayed gratification. So for him, any delayed gratification equals the sacrifice, but also what Jesus did is a sacrifice, right? So he is creating this package deal of both of those things. And I see it all over the place. I mean, you see it all the time of people confusing these two things. Talk a little bit about that. And again, about the kind of the cognitive confusion that creates about one's ability to think properly about self-interest, for example, about investing in the future.
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, Jesus is a little bit of a hard case because he's magic. And it's not clear to me whether he's supposed to know what's going to happen, that he's going to not really die, but fly away. And but if we take Jesus at face value,
I always say, you know, he's suffering and all this, and people say, no, he's God. I said, but if he's God, then it doesn't mean anything. And you can't get out of that loop of it's a very confusing example.
But if you take Jesus as a guy who's on the cross thinking, you know, why have you forsaken me, God? And you take someone like Mother Teresa as a kind of this worldly example of something like Jesus, right? Then this is just a very different thing from somebody who, buys Bitcoin because he rightly or wrongly thinks it's going to go up, or buys something that he's got more reason.
Gives up nice dinners for a year to start a business, or to raise his child, or whatever it is, you know.
Or just buys the iPhone, right? Yeah. Gives $1,000 and gets the iPhone 10.
You've got the 10. Now I'm jealous.
You don't have the 10.
No,
you're the big
I don't.
Apple fan.
I know.
So puts down $1,000 to buy the iPhone 10, right? Nobody calls that a sacrifice. Or if someone does, right, it's because they're using it as a gateway to get to really that's like what Jesus did.
Yeah.
But if you really believe in sacrifice, if you believe in what Christianity preaches under the heading of sacrifice, at least what most Christian preachers do, certainly if you believe in what modern ethicists believe when they say, you know, there's some conflict between self-interest and being really moral, then you have to make a distinction between doing what a simple case of making a choice of something you want more rather than something you want less, where there's some time element involved often, and a case of giving up something you want more because of something that you don't personally want, that doesn't feel like it's for you, but which you think trumps you, trumps what's important for you. And it's that concept that I think is the concept of a sacrifice. And if you don't have that concept, then I don't think you have the concept of a sacrifice. I don't think you could understand what's meant to be noble about what Jesus did or what Mother Teresa did to people who really think it's noble. And if you're somebody who does claim that those things are noble, and not just that they're noble, but they're the kind of epitome of nobility, right? Not just here's one nice thing. Then I think what you're doing is dishonest. You're trying to make that thing like standard cases of having integrity, or even simpler than having integrity, because maybe someone thinks integrity is a sacrifice. They think it's like what Jesus did. But simple cases of just, you know, delaying having the one marshmallow now so you could have two later in that test they give to the little kids to test whether they can, you know, hold off immediate gratification. If you're thinking of that as a sacrifice, you're running things together. And I don't think it's what even you really mean by sacrifice when you're talking about other cases.
But it makes it so difficult because it's so ingrained in our language and in our concepts. I mean, think about sacrifice fly in baseball, right? Or he sacrificed the shot to pass it. Or, you know, it's so part of the way people use the term that most people who don't think about morality are going to be confused by it, because it's just used in all these different ways that can't really integrate, but people hold somehow in their minds.
I mean, if somebody wants to rob the term of any meaning and use it in a very loose metaphorical sense, and say those things are sacrifices,
yeah,
I don't think it's good, because I think we need a term for real sacrifices, and I think moralists who are serious about sacrifice would agree with that. But if they want to do that, then they need some other term for those things.
Yep.
And you could say there are two meanings to sacrifice, and in some senses we use it this way, and in some cases we use it that way. But there's a difference between giving up your life, giving up what's important to you, because there's something you view as more important than your own life and your personal values. And the thing that everybody does all the time who's at all thoughtful, which is thinking of two things that are appealing, which one is more appealing, especially long-term, especially if you think in terms of not just what appeals to you in the instant, but you think causally about what will result in what, and then decide, I see this thing in context of its causes and effects. This one is the one that I find more appealing, even though if I drop or lose that context, the other one might seem more appealing.
Yeah, no, it surprises me that people who seem to be semi-good thinkers, you know, cannot make these differentiations. And again, there's a certain fuzziness about at the end of the day about their thinking when it comes to, particularly when it comes to moral issues.
You know, this is harder with religious people, because part of what religion does is, I think intentionally does, is distort this.
Yeah.
So it makes the long-term heaven, and it makes religion is an anti-causal way of thinking, right? Things happen because God wants them to, not because they have actual causes. And if they have actual causes in this world, they're the way God does what he does, even though that's incoherent, because you only have ways to do things if you have a limit to your power. If you were omnipotent, you wouldn't need a way to do something. It would just happen when you want it. But anyway, religion is a kind of anti-causal way of thinking, and that substitutes for thinking causally. And So on the one hand, it gets you against thinking of the actual causes and effects of your actions. And on the other hand, it substitutes for that thinking of some fantasy effect that it will have in the distant non-real future after your death or whatever. And if you buy into that, then you can think of or counterfeit to yourself thinking that what you're doing is getting for yourself a good life in the afterlife or contributing to some unintelligible purpose that God has or whatever other thing you might be doing, in which case none of these causal notions, you know, you can't say what's good or bad long term.
Since I brought up Jordan Peterson, so he uses this term. He talks a lot about meaning, the meaning of your life and where you get that meaning. And I think he has I don't completely understand what he means by it, but he has a kind of a metaphysical view of meaning, that it's out there and you need to discover it and bring it into your life. But objectivism has an important view on what it means to live a meaningful life, to have meaning in your life. Maybe talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, I don't know much about Peterson's view. I've seen some of his videos, but I haven't read either of his books. But I do think there's an important aspect to this idea of meaning in life. One, and again, it's not unique to Peterson. A lot of people have talked about this, that you want your life to be about something. You want your life to add up to something. You want your life to have some significance to you. And I think that's what the idea of a meaning in life is. And the objectivist view is that the meaning of your life is something you have to make. You have to choose, not discover as something that's preset and you find the script that you're meant to follow, which is in a way the Stoic view. Somebody mentioned Stoicism on one of the Facebook chats. But rather that you create something for your life to be about. And there's a beautiful scene in The Fountainhead, 75th anniversary of The Fountainhead just now, where Rourke is asked about the meaning of life, or the topic of the meaning of life comes up. And Rourke grabs a thick tree branch and bends it effortfully and says, so now it's in his control, right? And he shaped it. And he said, now I can make a railing out of it, or this out of it, or that out of it, and goes to the list of things he could do with it now that he's kind of understood how it works and shaped it to his will. And that's the meaning of life. And Wynand, who he's talking to, says, your strength. And he says, you know, no, I forget the exact words, but your work, what you choose to make of things. Yeah. And it's the idea that there are kind of natural materials out in the world and natural materials in yourself, whatever aptitudes you have or abilities or whatever it is, which can be further developed. But things in you, things in the world, things in your circumstance, you find yourself with those things. But you don't find in the same way something to do with your life. You make something to do with your life. And you make it by integrating the kind of primitive early values you have, the things that you're interested in before you have a, you know, worked out purpose for your life, before you have a career plan, before you're in love with someone maybe, but you have things that appeal to you and there are reasons why they appeal to you. And you think about what those are. You think about how they relate to each other. You think of what the causes and effects are. You think in some form, maybe not as articulately as I'm going to say, about what it is that a human being needs in order to survive and be happy. And that's things like a productive career, things like relationships that highlight and emphasize the values that are most important to him and let him experience them. And other such things, you think about all these things and you think, given my interests and my skills and the society that I'm in, what life can I make for myself that I would enjoy living that puts these together into a set of goals or a picture of what my life can be? And you build your life like that in the way that you can build an artwork.
Yeah.
And when you've done that, then your life becomes about something and it has meaning for you and it's valuable to you. And each of the individual bits of things that you were already attracted to, or already enjoyed that you put into it, become more enjoyable to you, more valuable to you, because they're part of this self-reinforcing whole. And it's a process that like creating an artwork. You know, happens over time. You have to iterate it. Maybe you change careers and you think then in changing careers about how your old career and your new career relate, what you're taking from the old one to the new one. You become a, you know, podcast host. And we've all had to do this. And, you know, Yaron, you've been around in my process of trying to do this. Sure. And we've talked about things. And it's but that's a process of thinking about what is it that I like about what I do? And why do I like it? And how can I have more of that? And how does that relate to the other things I want? And is where I live very important to me? And why? And how does that relate to my other values? And thinking about how to make something out of that. And that's what gives meaning to your life. And the fact that you're being productive, that you're creating things that are of value to other people, and other people matters, because if you're in a division of labor economy, you're you know, somehow by creating values that are things valuable also to other people, you're able to make a living and to survive, right? That that's part of it. But it's not that it's because it's good to them that it's meaningful. It's finding a way to make money things you love is part of how you make doing things you love a part of your life. Mm-hmm. And rather than a kind of hobby on the outside of your life. And finding, or that's peripheral to your life, and finding a way to make the thing that you do make the world better, better by your own judgment, better such that you can do more things like this in a world like that and the people you love can, is also part of having your values together and integrated and part of a whole where each one reinforces the other. And that's the kind of thing that I think gives meaning to a life. Not something you find, except in the way that you might think you find the idea for an artwork or a paper you write. It can seem like something you happen upon, but it's something you create and you evaluate.
So how would you differentiate meaning from purpose within the objectivist?
I don't think they're really that different. I don't think of meaning in life as a technical term in the way that purpose is. The purpose is the kind of central value around which you you integrate your life. In one sense, that's what purpose is. In another sense, a purpose is a thing that you're consciously pursuing. I think of meaning as the experiential side of that.
Okay.
So the experiencing of the things you're pursuing as worth pursuing, experiencing of your life as adding up to something, rather as therefore as purposeful as a whole, rather than as many discrete episodes that don't have any significance to you. It's the sort of experienced and intelligible value of your life as a whole, the direction you're going in as a whole.
Good. Okay, let's kind of step back a second. We were talking about selfishness, and you know, the other issue that has come out was the one debate I did about selfishness is the idea of the definition of selfishness, and of course, Ayn Rand has a whole theory of definitions and a real reason for why she used the word she used. So, two things I want to talk about: why did she use a word that was controversial? Why that emphasizes the radicalness? And second, how do we decide on a concept like selfishness whether the definition in the dictionary is right or isn't right?
Yeah, those are both good questions. So one thing we should think about with her usage, it's not that she uses this word selfishness every chance she gets, right? And I don't think the case that you have to fly in with the banner of selfishness is the first thing you say. Sometimes self-interest or egoism or rational. There are other words that are in some contexts the better word to use. But I do think it is important to fight for the word selfishness. And there are two contexts of that. One is I always object to, I never let it go by, people using selfishness in a negative way.
Yep.
I don't always fight for the positive usage of it, but I never don't demur in some way or other from a negative usage of it, because I think that's what's really toxic. And there are lots of kind of polite or not being too much of a social justice warrior-y for objectivism ways to demur from people using a negative usage of selfish. And I think of it in the same way that I would you know, a racial slur or some other thing in a context where people can more innocently use them, but still always to stop it. And the reason to do that is because the, and this will lead me into the positive usage, the negative usage of selfish, right, is that something's bad because it's self-interested. It's bad because it's coming from a motive of wanting to fulfill the self in some way. And that is never true of bad things. And it's usually obviously untrue of the things that it's said about. So if someone steals some money or something in a situation where it maybe seems like they could get away with it, you could see, you know, there's a certain rationale to calling it selfish and why someone might think that he's doing it for himself. And then you can, there's an interesting point to be made about how it's not really selfish. But a lot of the cases are ridiculous. I mean, I once was listening to a radio DJ talk about smoking. Smoking kills you. It destroys your lungs and you're going to die from it. How could someone be so selfish as to do that? I mean, you know, it shouldn't take much to say politely, why do you say it's selfish? The guy's killing himself. And you just said he's killing himself. Surely whatever is wrong with that, it's not that the person is too attached to himself.
I think the way they hold it is it's the short term, it's the pleasure, right?
Right.
And it's the real purpose in life is to take care of your family. And if you die, you know, people are going to, it's bad for the family. It's bad for other people if you die. And that's how they hold the whole mishmash.
I mean, right? Why would you think of yourself only as your immediate pleasure? And that's the one thing I would ask there. And as to the taking care of the family, I mean, if you're going to do some social welfare calculus, right, it's probably better that more people smoke. They die early and relatively quickly compared to other ways. It might be that, you know, the cost to the health system go up rather than down if people die of lung cancer. So who knows what the, you know, what the cost benefit for that. So there are these kind of obvious cases where the things that are said to be selfish aren't plausibly thought to either be benefiting the self or that the person's doing it because they're benefiting the self. And I think one can just point that out. And even in other cases, I think I always try to point out that the two things, that the action doesn't really benefit the person and that the person isn't really thinking about what benefits him in doing it. Yep. So Bernie Madoff in falling into this scam or this Elizabeth Holmes, the woman from
biotech company
who it seems people had high hopes for the company, but she fell into some kind of scandal. They fall into these things, right? Something goes wrong and they don't want to address it. And they're not thinking in that moment about what a plausible way out of this situation is to get back to where we can be living a productive, purposeful life and making progress. They just think about what they're afraid of in the moment and how to avert that fear. Often they're thinking of it as much for other people as for themselves, their investors, their friends, their family, whoever else it is. But what's going on is whoever they're focused on, the issue isn't that they're focused on them versus someone else. It's that they're focused, which they may not even be, it's that they're focused on avoiding, denying, not facing facts, not understanding the causal situation, rather than on trying to make and achieve something. So I try to properly name the flaws and notice that they don't have to do with the self or a kind of over-focus on the self. That I always do anytime that comes up. And you can usually do it pretty quickly. Just, you know, dissenting.
Sure.
Here's how I see it. As for why to use the term selfish, well, we don't have any positive or neutral term for acting in your self-interest, for thinking about what's good for you and trying to achieve it. We don't have a term for that. So it's not an accident that we don't have a term for it. We don't have a term for it because people don't think it's good. And they don't think there's such a thing as acting in your self-interest other than doing it in ways that are pretty obviously, when you start thinking about them, not good for you and not really motivated by thinking about what's good for you. And I think that second part is really important, that they're not good for you to be a crook, a cheat, a drug addict, but also someone who is a crook, a cheat, or a drug addict didn't become one in pursuit of some vision of what's good for him. He did it for the same types of reasons that most people do most of the things they do. They don't think one way or the other about what mm-hmm. the effects of this are going to be or about why they're doing it. It's just the thing to do in this situation, or it feels like the path of least resistance. And as often as not, the thing that feels like the thing to do or the path of least resistance in a situation is self-destructive. As often as not, it's the action that altruists would praise as altruistic. It's doing what your parents want of them. So it's not just that there's the good versus the destructive. There are all kinds of, I mean, the altruistic one is destructive, but there are all kinds of things that just feel like the thing to do in the moment. Some of them end up in a proper context helping you. Some end up hurting you. Some end up helping others. Some end up hurting others. Some of the ones that help others help you and vice versa, you know.
Yeah.
But there's, for most urges or desires or things that occur to someone to do most of the time, they don't occur as part of a view of what's good for me or of what's good for anyone else. They just occur like, here's a thing to do. And there's no word for acting in a principled way for yourself, doing things because they're good for you. That isn't one negative, and two, doesn't include all kinds of things that a few moments of thought should show you aren't really motivated like that. So you say, well, why don't we introduce a new word to do that? Well, because as soon as you do, you'll find op-eds in the New York Times or whatever talking about how, you know, well, it's the Trump administration that's really doing that, or Bernie Madoff who's really doing that, who's really acting self-interestedly or self-actualizingly or self-whateverly. And the reason that you'll get that is the same reason why any new word that was introduced for gay people took on a negative connotation. I mean, the word gay was introduced to be a positive word. But when I was a kid, you know, people would say, you know, oh, that's so gay. And I'd say things like that myself without thinking about it, right? And the reason why was that people had a negative attitude towards homosexuality. So any word that means homosexual will have a negative meaning.
Yep.
And you can't just keep on introducing new words. At some point you have to say, yeah, this word has a negative connotation because you think something is bad that I think is good. And I'm going to take my stand at this word now and say, here's why I think this thing is good. And anytime you do that, there's going to be some issue of teasing apart aspects of the meaning or connotation of the word. And, you know, a dictionary reports on all the aspects of usage. If it's doing its job well, it distinguishes them well enough. So it'll say this word is derogatory and so forth. But or this word includes this evaluation, but it'll treat it as an evaluation and we'll treat that as separate from the facts it's meant to pick out. But you have to kind of try to differentiate the things. And if you think of other cases of reclaiming words that have had negative connotations, some of which I think are good and some of which I don't think are good, they all involve this. They all involve saying, well, being gay or being queer or being whatever doesn't involve some of the things that it often thought to and is even sometimes seen as part of the meaning of the word. It just means such and such. My favorite example of this, to use as an example, though I don't actually agree with what the authors are doing, is there's a book called The Ethical Slut. And there are these things called slut walks where women walk around and say, we're sluts and we're proud. And they say that what they're doing is reclaiming the word slut. And slut, as normally used, means it's got to be a woman. She's got to sleep with a lot of partners. She has to have no discrimination, whatever. But the way we mean it, it could be someone of either gender who is guiltless about sex. And, you know, she might only have one partner, but she's, you know, throws out conventional mores about it. Now, I don't think that's a good thing to do with the word slut, because I think there is, as the authors who do this don't think, there is a way to go wrong by being too morally wrong, by being too indiscriminate in your sexual partners.
Yep.
And that one, you know, needs a word for that. But whether it's separate for women and men is another question. That's an interesting thing to do with the use of sexuality. But I think there is a need for a word nearer to the conventional meaning of slut than they do. But what's interesting to me about that example, and I think it comes up in any kind of case where you have a view that's radically different from the mainstream and you want to kind of make clear that it is that you're going to have to take a word and you're going to have to say, look, you use it this way. But the reason why you use it this way is because you think there's such a thing as having too much sex in defiance of sex with too many people or too many different types of people in defiance of morality. And we don't think there's such a thing. And if you don't think there's such a thing, that word is not going to make sense the way you use it. And we're going to push this usage. And I think that's the same thing that goes on with using selfish in this way.
Yeah.
I think there are times to forwardly use it in this way and times not to. But that's what's accomplished. You're kind of taking a stand and saying, we understand this word differently and we're using it in a way that's uncomfortable to you. And that fits in a kind of oddish way with the conventional usage of it, because we want to call attention to wrong beliefs that are presupposed in the common usage and tease apart the aspects we agree with and disagree with. That's a confrontational posture to take. I think it's the right one to take sometimes, not always, but I think it's always right to, that is if you think the objectivist ethics is right, as I do, to object to the negative usage of it.
Yep. No, I agree. I agree with all that. Absolutely. Somebody's asking online, they're saying, to what extent do you think that the difficulty in having these conversations comes from the prevalence of skepticism out there, the prevalence of the people don't believe in anything firm and are skeptical of any appeal to principle? Appeals to reality to some extent.
It probably depends on who you're talking to. I mean, and I would separate skepticism as a philosophical position from just being unprincipled, being unused to thinking in principle, principles feeling floating to you, right? That's a one thing, and that's not the same thing as being a skeptic where you're, you know, in principle averse to principles and the idea of knowledge. I think the fact that people don't think abstractly enough, don't think in principles enough, and that's not a fact that's particular to our society. It's just, it's hard to, and it takes training to, and people haven't had it. And maybe they've had it less than at some other time, but more than at some other. The fact that people aren't thinking in principle poses a challenge. And one has to think about how to connect to them, how to find the things in them that are best, that are closest to principles, or that are such that they're most able to abstract a principle from it and find a way to work from that. And it's, you know, it's difficult, but it's not like there's a default world where, which is the world as it ought to be, where everything is easy and good. And everybody already knows all the true things, and your job is easy, and all you have to do is, you know, turn a crank, and everybody believes what they should believe if you're a philosopher, or buys your product if you have a new idea for a product. But part of living a life is figuring out what the world you're in is, and then how to achieve what you want to achieve in that world, and not thinking that reality owes you a world or a society where what you want to do would be easy. I wish people thought in principle more. I wish there was a better early education, but I don't boo-hoo about that too much. I just try to think of what I can do to either make it happen in the future or address the situation now, and both of them ideally. And you know, it could be a lot better with respect to education, but it could also be a lot worse. I mean, we could be living in the Middle Ages or, you know, in Stone Age times or in, you know, Pakistan today or something. There are lots of places where people are a lot less able to think in principle than, you know, in New Jersey or Puerto Rico today.
So, I'm having good experience here in Puerto Rico. We'll see what we can do. That brings up a good point, and we've got about 10 minutes, so let's maybe end on this point. I find that there's so many among objectivists who get very discouraged and very depressed so easily, and I think it relates to the point you just made of the world as it is and what we can do about it. And so And I do think I don't know how accurate this concept is, but I like the idea of being irrationally optimistic. And even though what we hope that is realistic, but I think with a positive perspective on the world, because I think there's a lot in the world that is positive. I'm curious what you think about that and how you keep and people ask me this all the time, so I'm going to ask you, how you keep kind of a positive frame of mind given, I mean, I think we agree in politics, we agree on a lot of things, that things are really bad. I mean, and culturally, that there's a lot of bad things going on, and the really problems of while we're certainly not in the dark ages, we're still fighting to prevent that from happening one day because we don't know what's going to happen. How do you keep that positive perspective given the world in which we live and given the ideas that we hold?
Well, let me say, I've always tended to be more on the positive side, and I'll say why I have been. But I just want to say first, as context for this, I think that America is in way worse shape than I thought it was 3 years ago.
Yep.
A lot worse. I thought it was better than it was 3 years ago, and I think events since have shown me that there were more cracks than I thought there were then. They were bigger than I thought they were then, and they've gotten a lot worse since. And I think the country is in a really, really bad way right now.
Yep.
So I don't want anything I say positive to be, you know, oh, everything's cool. And I also think it's more important to think about how to maintain a positive and life-oriented perspective in light of revelations that things might be worse than you thought. And that those revelations have shook me, and they've made me think about how I want to prioritize what I do differently and what, you know, I haven't reached any particular decisions about them, but as I think about, do I want to write this paper and what's the point of it or that paper or do this podcast or whatever, these things have been in my mind that I don't yet have a fully worked out answer to those questions. You know, one's always adjusting one's goals.
Absolutely.
But this has been a hard period for me. But that said, you're not, the project of life isn't a project of coming into a world that's a prepared environment for you. And, you know, we should try to make prepared environment for our kids, but coming into a world that's a prepared environment for you and playing a preset role that's meant to bring you happiness. And if you have that view, you're never going to be happy. And you're always going to be frustrated by the world you're in. That's just not the nature of nature and the nature of human beings. And the nature of what a human being is and what the world is like is that you have to figure out, given the world you're in and given your abilities, what kind of a life you can make for yourself and find a way to make it. And if you accept that as the problem to be solved in a human life, then a lot of things that seem like they're unfairnesses, and they might actually be unfair in some cases, and a lot of them are, a lot of things that seem like unfairnesses or setbacks, you acknowledge them as such, then you just take them as part of the context in which you have to do the job of living.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas if you expect to be handed a world in which it's easy to have a good life, again, you're always going to be dissatisfied. And then you take that whole perspective, I think, is important. And then when you take that perspective, I mean, look at the world. There is so much we could do and so much possible to us. And when would you have rather have been born? I mean, in some utopia that doesn't yet exist, that it's your job to help try to create, well, then go sit trying to create it. Or in some past period, and any past period that you might romanticize and might rightly romanticize because it had a lot of really good things about it, also has a lot of really bad things about it. I mean, it's only in the 20s that women got the vote. If you're a woman, I mean, living before then is really awful. And if you're a man, it's awful too, because who wants to, you know, if you're a heterosexual, but either way, who wants to be in a world where half the people you deal with are disenfranchised or seen as second-class citizens? Who are you going to marry? People couldn't be educated. And think about, you know, if you watch television shows about the 50s, and not to mention, you know, black people or people of other races.
Yep.
And this is not just bad for them, right? It's bad for you as a allegedly privileged white man. I mean, who are you going to be friends with? Who are you going to benefit from? So who are you going to trade? Who are you going to relate to? So just the obvious changes that the leftists would kind of focus on, right, in the last half century have been these race and sex ones. Not that everything's gotten good with those things. It hasn't, but certain evils have been eliminated. And those are real things you have to think about if you think about, I'd rather live in the 50s when everything was better, supposedly, which it wasn't. Some things were better and some were worse. And likewise, all the technology you'd be giving up. I mean, how much easier it is if you think the culture is worse as a whole, which it's not totally clear to me is, but parts of it certainly are, how much easier it is now to find the niches in it mm-hmm. of people who you're interested in. How much more entertainment, intellectual content there is, even if that you can find, because you can do web searches on it and go and have podcast conversations. I mean, there's a lot good now. It's not clear that there's a time when things were in – there's no time when things were in every way better. And in every time when they were in some ways better, they were in some ways worse. Yep. And if you're someone who has real values, right, things that you care about and are making your life about, there are things that you've become attached to and care about and are making your life about in this world. And so you can't want some other world that's nothing like it.
Yep.
Or that's like it only in some abstract way. I think Harry Binfanger, somebody told the story about Ayn Rand being asked, you know, if some aliens came and could take her away to some totally rational future or other planet or something, would she do it? And they were totally capitalist there and so forth. And her answer was, well, she'd have to give up all the things that she loved here. And that would be my answer too. I don't know if she really said that. I only vaguely remember the anecdote. But, you know, I have a wife here and a job here and friends here and things I like that I've made in this world. And they have a kind of coherence to them and a trajectory that I think is making the world better and making my life better. And that's what I value, not the life I would have in some utopia that I'm always, you know, complaining that this life isn't it.
Yeah. And I think it's the living your life focused on those things, focused on the things that you're building. It's, I think it boils down to having a life of meaning, having a life of purpose. And I think that when people don't, when their purpose, when they haven't built themselves a life that means something to them, then all they do is yearn for some utopia and are constantly frustrated and angry and disappointed in the world in which they live. They're not being selfish. They're not being self-interested in the full sense of what that means.
I think that's right. And utopian longings and kind of ideals that are disconnected from anything you can do to actually reach them, that you could expect to succeed at or at least make real progress at and enjoy that progress. Any ideal like that is not really a value and not really an ideal. It's a kind of rationalization or excuse for not making your life better.
Great. Good. Good way to... Well, we shouldn't end on the positive, making your life better. Anyway.
well, let's end with what an actual ideal is, right? And an actual real ideal is something that's difficult but achievable, that you have reason to think is achievable, that you have actual views. There's actions you know you can take to bring it into reality, and you're taking them. And when you're working towards that kind of a future for yourself and for the world, then you experience yourself as focused on that future. You live in it today, as Galt puts it in Atlas Shrugged.
Yep.
And I think as Rand puts it elsewhere, but Galt makes a similar point in Atlas Shrugged. And you have a sense of progress and achievement. And I'm not saying that I have that all the time or I've got everything worked out. But I have it enough of the time that I'm happy with my life and trying to get more of it. And it's something we can all do, I think.
Yes, and absolutely. So I think everybody can achieve it in whatever way. And they don't have to have this goal of changing the world. They don't have to have this big goal. It's the purpose that you have in your life. It's the meaning you bring to your life. But taking that seriously and thinking about it and integrating it into everything you do in your life is what's going to make you have that same sense about your life.
And it's what's going to make the world worth changing for you.
Yep.
Because if you're someone who's not going to do what it takes to make your life better, whatever world you're in, then it's not worth making the world better for yourself.
Yeah. Great. Thanks, Greg.
Just, one thing to do in closing, because Ben Bayer's texting me and bugging me to do it, which is to promote the Atlas Project, which I mentioned at the beginning.
Yep.
This is the weekly discussion group Ben Bayer and I are leading on Atlas Shrugged for the Ayn Rand Institute. This Tuesday, 7 o'clock Eastern time, we are resuming with our discussion of John Galt's speech, where a lot of the ideas we talked about today are articulated.
And how important is it for somebody to have listened or watched the previous episodes if they want to just jump in right now? Is that okay?
I think they can jump in right now, especially because we're doing Galt's speech, which is possible to read on its own. I wouldn't recommend jumping in if you haven't read the novel already.
Yeah.
But if you've read the novel at least up to part 3, chapter 7, then there's no reason to be caught up on past episodes. You can, if you like it, you can, you know, backtrack and listen to those later.
Good. Yes. So everybody, and they can find it on Facebook, right? It's all
they can find it on Facebook. Also, there's a URL atlasproject.live, which if you go to takes you to a page on Ayn Rand campus that has all the information and the links on it, or just Facebook. There's a Facebook group called Atlas Project, and that has all the information in it.
So Atlas. Yeah, go ahead.
Like the Atlas Shrugged page on Facebook. That's the other important thing to do for that.
Yes, the Atlas Shrugged page on Facebook, Atlas Project, and you can find the old shows all on the Atlas Project site on the ARI's campus, and of course on Facebook on the group page on Facebook. So
also,
and it's Galt's speech is, you know, an essentialized version of the entire philosophy of objectivism as Ayn Rand presented it. To really dig into that and to chew that is an incredible value with two philosophers, Greg and Ben. So I encourage all of you to join in. Great. Thanks, Greg.
Thanks for having me on.
Have a rest of a great Sunday. Thank you all for listening. And don't forget to go to Patreon, supports the show. Thank you for those of you who did the, I forget what it's called, the YouTube something where you give money on YouTube. Thank you for doing that. Go subscribe to my YouTube channel. Do all the things you know to do on social media. Share. That's an important one. All right. Have a great day, Greg. Bye.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye, everybody. End meeting. End episode.